It's 11 o'clock, and you know that time. It's time for the Hometown Daily News Show. It's a podcast. It's a website. I'm Mayor Watt. That's hometown.com. I stream here on Twitch. I copy it over to YouTube. It's also a podcast via pretty much anything. But what is Hometown? Hometown is a news aggregation site, and then I talk about it. It funnels news into six main categories: create, news, education, entertainment, social, and technology. And then there's 50 channels under that, all of which I hope one day to bring to Twitch and or YouTube. It really depends how this all works out. But I will continue to stream at 11 o'clock. The last 2 weeks have been kind of rough. I had made plans and then people and kind of upset the turnip cart. At any rate, let's get into today's news. The very first article is in the Smack Talk channel, where there's a comparison between the Apple Studio Display and the Dell UltraSharp 32 4K video conferencing monitor. I've been looking at other monitors, but you know what I really want is I want augmented reality glasses that allow me to throw a monitor wherever I want to throw a monitor instead of having copious amounts. I actually got rid of two of my monitors. I used to have five monitors here, but I got rid of two of them. It makes work a little bit more difficult because I have to move things around, I guess, tech problems as it is. But bigger monitors, ultra wides, those are really what I'm looking for. But I would rather have no monitors. I'd rather have augmented reality where I can just throw, kind of like HoloLens, throw a monitor wherever I want it in virtual space and then come back into my office and just sit down and there they are, just put my glasses on these. And I'm hoping that that's what's going to happen. At Worldwide Developers Conference, rumors abound, but let's look at this source for this comparison. It's an article over at appleinsider.com by Malcolm Owen, and they talk about the Dell UltraSharp 32 4K and the Apple Studio Display. And they say that the Apple Studio Display is a cheaper monitor than the Pro Display XDR, but by no means can you call it budget friendly. We'll see the price down at the bottom, I'm sure. I haven't looked at what the article has to say. But the Dell UltraSharp 32 4K is larger, doesn't have the same resolution, but has HDR 400, not as bright, has a greater contrast ratio. It says True Tone, so the colors are more accurate, supposedly, in the Apple Studio Display. It has a webcam that's only 12 megapixels versus the Dell, which is 4K. Sony Starvis CMOS sensor. AI auto framing, so it's going to move around. Really, the Dell UltraSharp is a commercial-grade video conferencing monitor, and it's quite a bit larger, so if you're looking for something that's actually bigger, higher resolution, greater contrast, but not necessarily as bright, you would probably want to go with the Dell UltraSharp. And the price difference, there isn't a price difference. It's basically a dollar, 99 cents. So I would probably go with the Dell, but I've always gone with something other than Apple monitors. Only because I think that you get the same type of technology at a lower price, and because there's increased competition for non-Apple branded products, you get more features at a lower price. So I would probably go with the Dell. I use Asus everywhere, at least at this point. It used to be LG. For some reason, I recall LG supplying the panels for Asus, but don't hold me to that. I'm not quite sure. I'd have to look into it. And since I don't edit my videos, except for the intro and outro. Anyway, this article goes into greater detail per each monitor and kind of talks about the feature set. But I would encourage you to go and look at it. They have a great little chart that shows all of the specifications in it, but they give their perspective in greater detail in the article. So I'm just kind of scrolling through here to see if there's anything particularly amazing. It says going for a Visa mount instead of the stand keeps the price the same, whereas the tilt and height adjustable stand adds $400. So that's the Apple Studio Display. Pretty much like anything Apple related, you have to pay a premium for it, and it's part of the industrial design. I'm not quite sure about the features accounting for that price, but hiding cables and whatnot, not everybody really cares about cables. I hate cables. I don't want cables anywhere, but for what it's worth, I'm not going to pay $500 just to hide cables in a prettier stand. So let's scroll back up, and I would recommend getting the Dell UltraSharp 32 4K. I'm not a big fan of the integrated camera, but it is what it is. If you want a one-stop shop, then go for the Dell. You'll get more bang for your buck. Not sure how the warranty or longevity is, but there you go. Let's go on to the next article. The next article is in the Smack Talk channel. The Mac Mini Tower, M2 Mac Mini listed by B&H before WWDC. An Apple-authorized reseller may have tipped the introduction of two Mac Mini models for WWDC 2022, including an M2-equipped version of a Mac Mini Tower. In the run-up to Monday's WWDC keynote, rumors reach fever pitch as observers speculate on Apple's upcoming announcements. In the case of one retailer, it seems the two pieces of Mac hardware could make an appearance. I'm going to click the link so that we can take a little gander at it. This is an article over at Apple Insider as well, by Malcolm Owen as well. And if that's the dimensions of the tower, yeah, I'm on board. I'll end up probably getting one of these. I've been considering switching over everything to Mac for streaming, but not for gaming. It just doesn't work that way. At least for me. And I think that it's again for me, because of what I do, it kind of makes a great fit because I do quite a few different things on different platforms. And I really like the Apple platform. It was my primary until I started streaming more. And at least for non-work related stuff. For work related stuff, I'm all over the place from Linux to and its various distros to Windows. And I always use the Mac for my personal stuff. Anyway, it's drop dead simple. It has longevity. I've never had a real problem with any of my Mac stuff, not unless something catastrophic happened, like I dropped. I had a MacBook Pro that I had purchased, and within a week, my bag slipped off my shoulder, and the straps were long enough that by the time I caught the bag, it had hit the corner and smashed it, and kind of bent the corner of the screen a little bit. And I ended up selling it, but not until after years went by. I mean, it was a really old device, but it still was a juggernaut. It still worked without a problem, no damage to the screen. It just banged up the corner because the aluminum bent a little bit. But the owner is happy. The new owner is happy. At any rate, I love these Mac Minis. I actually have, let's see, there's a stack of four of them right over there. but they're really old. And now they're pretty much not going to be supported, and they won't drive any of the new software, I'm sure of it. They're just sitting there because that they're not as capable anymore, at least in their current configuration. I'm sure that they would be great as file servers or something like that. At any rate, why am I telling you all of this? I don't know why. Just more context, I suppose. So let's see. There's no image available on the B&H site, according to the article, but it's definitely something there. No price appears to be there either. So it's really, there's going to be another iteration of the Mac Mini platform. Looks like it's getting thinner and maybe a little bit wider. And that's fine with me. I love these little things. If you can stick them on their side and slide them into a bookcase, you would never even know you have a computer, except for the cables running everywhere, which again, I really don't like cables. Let's continue on to the next article, because there isn't really much known about it. Just know that tomorrow, some new hardware may drop from Apple. The next article is over in the Hatch Ideas channel. Ford's electric F-150 Lightning made off-roading easy and fun, even for someone with zero skills or talent, according to this author. They took the Ford all-electric F-150 Lightning off-roading. They said that they're a mediocre off-roader, but the F-150 Lightning filled in for their lack of skills. Yeah, a lot. You have to make certain concessions when you're off-roading, when a vehicle doesn't have as much power, torque, flexibility. But when you've got an electric vehicle, it's pretty much instant on. You don't have to worry about compression, spooling up torque, and waiting for something to occur. There's very little lag between you mashing the pedal or pushing the button, so to speak, because that's what it is. And I'm sure I've been told several times now by different people that the F-150 is a pretty amazing truck, and that you have to dial back. Otherwise, it tends to overpower you until you're more familiar with it, of course. Like all things, becoming familiar with it is pretty key. It says, the author says that they'll be the first to admit when it comes to driving off-road that they have almost no idea what they're doing. So let's click the link. It'll take us over to Business Insider. And then Tim Levin is the author of the article. This is the first time I've seen a black F-150 Lightning talked about in an article. Every other one that I've seen is either white or silver. So kudos to you for bucking the trend, at least in my eyes. Pretty neat truck. I like the idea of an all-electric truck. I've actually been looking for a truck so that I can actually get sheet goods so that I can build some stuff. And it's really hard to do that in anything other than a truck. And I really want to switch away from combustion engines. But again, I've said this in other streams, it's just really tough because I don't think the infrastructure is there to support at the same level and lifestyle that I'm leading now. So, the Lightning isn't designed to be a hardcore off-road truck for the most unforgiving terrain. For that, you're better off with the gasoline-powered steroid-injected cousin, the F-150 Raptor. But the Lightning still has what it takes to hit some trails. I think it has more than that. But with greater stress, greater resistance, the battery drains faster. It's just the nature of resistance. And so, as you apply more power, trying to overcome some obstacle in a combustion engine, you're just increasing your torque until you can overpower it. But with an electric vehicle, you've got the motor that is basically being given more charge to overcome it, and it just drains the battery faster. For starters, all Lightnings come with two motors and all-wheel drive, making it a sure-footed and grippy on sketchy surfaces. All trucks from the $40,000 base model all the way up to the $90,000 Platinum Edition promise to generate 775 pound-feet feet of torque. In layman's terms, that's more oomph for pulling trailers and climbing boulders than any other F-150 before it. Ta-dun. So why would you want to get the Raptor other than maybe the suspension difference? Pardon me one second. Nothing says pro streamer like sneezing while you're streaming. At any rate, I like the F-150. I just don't have the space for it. So, got to get one of those 12-car garages so that I can get everything that I want. That's not going to happen. At any rate, let's go on to the next article. It is Abbott Nutrition restarts the baby formula production in reopened Michigan plant. I guess they found the bug and stomped it out, but let's see what happens. Abbott Nutrition has resumed baby formula production in its Sturgis, Michigan plant in a move that aims to address nationwide shortage. I think we've got a bigger problem than that, and that is that this one plant was responsible for 25% of baby formula in the United States. I think that's unacceptable. I don't think that it should be consolidated to that point simply because you are meeting the FDA requirements. I think that it should be addressed in that the requirements should be publicly known. The formula, because it's a recipe, should be publicly known. It should not be kept a business secret. And for the good of everybody, I think that it should be public. And the procedure to make baby formula be put back in the hands of the people that are having the babies, you know? If there needs to be oversight, then so be it. Let's create some policy or procedure so that it can be overseen. But for one company to control 25%, I think it's a little unacceptable, particularly when it's something as basic as food. So this article is over at CNBC by Kate Dorr. And the key points in the article, it says Abbott Nutrition has resumed baby formula production in a Sturgis, Michigan plant in a move to address nationwide shortage. And the company said it'll restart the production of Elicare, a formula for children with digestive issues, aiming for an initial product release around June 20th. So, yeah, I think that that's fine. And it, you know, it doesn't matter that they start back up when all it takes is one bug and you're shutting down 25%. And then all the rest, everything else, the price shoots through the roof or it becomes entirely unavailable, all because of one point of failure. That is very difficult to stamp out. You know, just a bug got into the system and it was difficult to find and remove. And you have to, you are monitored. So you have to meet somebody else's demands, somebody else's requirements. And that's good because you are supplying 25% of the food to infants. But again, it comes back to, it is a single point of failure, an invisible creator of illness or even death got into the system and it wasn't seen until people were harmed. And then it was monitored. But if it would have been one person that got it, because they're making this formula at home, at least there would have been some direct monitoring. You know, baby gets sick, they get taken to the hospital, and boom, you've got something, somebody immediately reacting to this sick baby. Whereas other complaints, it funnels into and an investigation has to take place and so on and so forth. You know, put feeding babies in the hands of the people that are having the babies. I don't know. But I think that communities should be making stuff more locally anyway. From growing plants to producing something like infant formula. So it says the FDA is continuing to work diligently to ensure the safe resumption of production of infant formula at Abbott's Nutrition Sturgis, Michigan facility, said the FDA in a statement. So here's to getting things back on track. Not necessarily how I would think that they should be. I don't have a lot of articles, by the way, today. Sunday is typically a slow news day, and where I would normally go through twice as many pages of news over the last 24 hours, it just wasn't. Sundays are slow. Anyway, in the Continuity Report, which is a show about movies, Top Gun Maverick has a secret weapon even its makers didn't know about. A great and timely villain, hint, it's Russia. I'm going to click the link, take us over to Variety.com, and Owen Gleiberman is the author of this article. And unlike the original Top Gun, where it was just this nebulous villain, they weren't named in the original Top Gun, at least as far as I recall. They didn't name who the villain was. But in this case, yeah, it's Russia. And I kind of figured that that is what was going to come out of that. Not really sure why, but it says the striking, if not really shocking, success of Top Gun Maverick is built around the simple fact that it's an exquisitely executed blockbuster. It seems to have everything a commercial retro action movie would need, a prime movie star, one of the only ones left who still knows how to fold a movie around his image, jaw-dropping aerial combat sequences that blow away any hint of green screen fakery because those are real actors lifting off and flying. The kind of 80s nostalgia. I was told, though, that he wasn't actually flying any military craft, but maybe that's not true. Maybe, I don't know, maybe the wires are getting crossed. But my understanding was that he wasn't allowed to actually fly. Anyway, it's more like nostalgia for nostalgia. A story just good enough to pluck every carefully planted heartstring of authority figure versus cocky upstart. So, Val Kilmer was there. Apparently, he can't speak, so they synthesized his voice, which really sucks. I've always liked Val Kilmer. I don't know what to say, but it just kind of sucks that. And he's lost his voice. Anyway, I don't think that it really is. I think that it's popular because it's a popular thing and it's big, it's bombastic, it's out there. I don't think that it has anything to do with Russia. I really don't. I don't think that word of mouth has said, "Oh, look, the villain is Russia. Go see Top Gun." I don't think that's what it is. I don't think that the commercials highlight it as being Russia. I don't think that it's known as being Russia until you're watching the movie. And I'm waiting so that I can watch it in my home theater instead of going to a movie theater. But their crews actually required the movie to go through the theaters, not straight to purchasing it at things like Apple TV, Apple Movies. But it hit the ground running and has just record numbers. It's amazing. But you know, after two plus years of pandemic and we're literally shut-ins that we can't go anywhere unless we want to risk getting sick, we're there. People are tired of it, so they went out. But I think that unless something, whatever the next great pandemic is. I think people are going to catch up quick and not worry about going to movie theaters. But for a short time being, I think it'll hit some pretty big numbers. I'm not going to go through this whole article. I think I'm going to ask you guys to go look at it. I want you, the listeners to this podcast or the YouTube channel or to here on Twitch, go over and read the rest of this Variety article. Because I'm thinking that it's not, it has nothing to do with Russia. It's just that it is a, it's a another episode in Top Gun, and it's riffing off of the history of Top Gun. And there's a lot of people that are still fascinated with all of this. So let's continue on to the next article. Oh my goodness. I don't know what it is that every once in a while my aggregator grabs something and it's really wonky. So I'm just going to go straight on over to it. The article is this 3D printed robotic arm the future of prosthetics? And it takes me over to The Hill. And it says Unlimited Tomorrow is a small company in Rhinebeck, New York that has figured out a way to reduce the price of high quality bionic prosthetics by as much as 90%. And yeah, of course it's going to be 3D printed. It is projected that there are more than 57 million amputees worldwide, and only 5% of them have access to prosthetic care and technology. Those that do have access to prosthesis are often burdened with an inconvenient fitting and training process, high price tags of up to $80,000, and long wait times for of more than a year. It's because the technology hasn't been kind of mass-produced with a bunch of competitors that... I think that there's a lot of profit in that exclusivity of basically what she's having to deal with. And by she, there's a person on the stream who is from YouTube, Ab Show. Let me back up a little bit. Let me see if I can. I don't normally show video. So it's Ab Show Faux Show, ABSHOWFOSHO, over on YouTube. And they are missing their arm just under their elbow, but they're playing guitar and doing other things and kind of showing people that they're just as capable as other people, just in a different way, right? So the company's True Limb is a durable 3D printed prosthetic arm with bionic functionality. So it has the ability to open fingers, close fingers, maybe even rotate the wrist. I didn't see all of it. But a small prosthetics company called Unlimited Tomorrow in Rhinebeck, New York is shaking things up. Unlimited Tomorrow was founded in 2014 by robotics prodigy Easton LaChapelle. When LaChapelle was 14 years old, he created a control glove-operated bionic hand and entered it into the Colorado State Science Fair. LaChapelle's project caught the eye of a 7-year-old amputee who was wearing a bionic prosthetic. LaChapelle learned that her prosthetic, which wasn't much more sophisticated than the science project he created in his bedroom, cost $80,000. And they are actually even more expensive than that. Pardon me. This is really underselling the price of bionic prosthetics. There are much higher end ones. He spent the next few years researching how he could improve the current state of the prosthetics industry. I think one of the biggest issues really is that it's hard to control prosthetic limbs, because it's really about sensors that are attached within the cup that is, for lack of a better term, suction cupped onto the remainder of the limb. And there's research that's going into being able to control the bionic limb, but it's all fundamental research, and I don't think that a lot of companies see massive amounts of profitability, because it's an extremely expensive process of doing fundamental research for this kind of thing. But it's a quality of life issue for many people. and something that either there needs to be profitability in, and hence a business rationale, or a common good in society, which doesn't necessarily lead to high profits. So I'm glad that there is somebody out there that sees a possible solution. And it says that the centralization of the process also allows Unlimited Tomorrow to sell their devices at a steep discount to legacy prostheses, with TrueLimb devices starting at just $8,000. And I think that's probably, most of that is probably in the customization element, scaling the parts, and an engineer sitting there doing the 3D modeling to make the TrueLimb more directly compatible with the future user of the limb, the bionic arm. I think that it's commendable, and I really think that regardless of what the issue is that lands a person needing a prosthetic limb, I think that society as a whole should be able to facilitate offsetting the costs to a great degree. And if we can get this down to $8,000, the true cost of this is about the profitability on the other side of it. You know, is $8,000 the real cost, or is there a lot of making money on even the $8,000 because of the way that it is done? And I'm sure that they're addressing that to lower the cost even more so. And maybe even grants or some program can be spun up that offsets even these costs. I mean, we have billionaires, for crying out loud. They could pay for $1 billion worth of TrueLimb devices that are custom made, and it would, the interest on that $1 billion would pay alone for unlimited numbers of prostheses, at least until somebody figured out how they can, oh look, all of that money chasing after our limbs, let's start raising the price. Not saying that TrueLimb will do that, but people tend to do that in businesses. There were drugs that were really inexpensive, and then somebody came along and said, well, let's ramp that price up 15,000%. And then people have to figure out, can I eat or can I get my medicine that keeps me alive? Just kind of sucks. Anyway, good on La Chapelle for producing these. I've got several 3D printers, and if they are capable of doing something like this, then I would even offer them up as a platform to produce. But nowadays, 3D printers are pretty inexpensive if they meet the requirements for this. You know, I don't think it really says what the material is. Let me scroll down again and see. I don't think it says what it's made out of, what the limb, the prosthetic limb is made out of. I doubt that it's just PLA. PLA is a little bit more subject to the environment than even PETG. Okay. Anyway, go over to this article at The Hill. It's written by Richie Hertzberg. And it must have been updated because today is the 5th and it was actually published on the 3rd. So something must have happened to pull it up so my aggregator saw it again. Okay, so the next article is in the continuity report. I have to admit that both of these are good calls, along with another one. I'm not sure if I actually grabbed it. It was at the, let me scroll back here a second. Yeah, Love, Death, and Robots. This right here. Love, Death, and Robots is great. It's like old school heavy metal. It's an anthology animation. And maybe even sometimes crossover. I don't recall if it crossed over into anime and real life, but I can't remember what they refer to that as. But at any rate, this article over on the Continuity Report is talking about Stranger Things Season 4 and Obi-Wan Kenobi, the premiere, came with record numbers of viewers. It said, Better Call Saul also breaks some viewer records for AMC, plus Jodie Foster joins True Detective, James Marsden returns to Westworld. Trailers and series Gotham Knights, and a movie, a Beavis and Butthead Do the Universe, and more TV and streaming news over at this article from Rotten Tomatoes. So this is an article by Kimberly Potts, and okay, so I cannot believe that Beavis and Butthead are returning. It feels like it's been 30 years. I cannot believe that Westworld is coming back. I thought that that was done. It seemingly had ended. Deus Machina is probably the nearest parallel, and perhaps I'm mixing them up because I swear Westworld ended with an actual end. Maybe not. I mean, I'll have to go back and watch the end. I really think that things are going to go a completely different direction than from Westworld. I can't imagine anybody trusting a robot, Android or whatever. But Stranger Things Season 4 was spectacular. I binge-watched everything that was out there. And, I really love the pacing of the series. Everything that was done was pretty amazing. Every once in a while, I'd find something that I kind of asked why. I can't even talk about it. I really don't want to spoil anything. If you're going slow through the season, I don't want to spoil it for you, so I won't even bother. But there were a couple of things where I would just kind of going, huh? But then they addressed it in the same episode to some degree. You know, phrasing like, they wouldn't be dumb enough to ... Yeah, they would be dumb enough to do that. And Obi-Wan Kenobi is kind of dripping out, and I like it. I think it's kind of funny that one of the memes that I saw was amounted to, well, we know what happens with Kenobi, so why are we watching this? Well, it's a fun story thing, and nothing really spoils things for me, but not everybody is the same way. But record number of viewers shows that people are still embracing the online venue instead of being forced to go out or watch standard television. Oof, gosh, that is not a good angle. They in the stream and on the page that I link to, they have a scene from Stranger Things. So I liked the series or this season. So I thought it was great. And the soundtrack is really good too. I haven't looked at Gotham Knights. I don't know if I'm going to watch it. Maybe a couple of episodes. And they talk about a bunch of other things over on this article. So if you are interested in TV and movies, definitely go over to Rotten Tomatoes. Follow that link in the show notes and you'll get just bombarded by a bunch of news. I'm just highlighting a couple of the things that are over there. And the next one is about Westworld. I actually spoke about it just now. I thought that Westworld was pretty much done at the end of its last season. It had gone off the reservation, so to speak. They've left Westworld. And that's pretty much where I thought it was going to end, you know. But James Marsden, who starred in the first season of HBO's Westworld, and Rick Hurd in its second season is coming back. The network announced the news on Saturday at the ATX Television Festival in Austin, where Marsden made a surprised appearance during a panel promoting the show's season 4. So let's click the link again. And it takes us over to Variety, and Michael Schneider is the author of the article. And let's see if there's anything interesting in here. It says, also part of the panel, HBO released key art for the new season, which returns Sunday, June 26th at 9 p.m. They had a panel at this ATX Television Festival, and various people in here. It says on Westworld, Marsden originally played Teddy Flood, the new marksman in town, as tradition. Joy and the producers are mum on how Marsden's return will play out in the show, and Marsden didn't give any hints. So it's all going to be cloak and dagger until the shows come out. But the key art here, it has a picture of a skull being held by robots and the phrase adapt or die. Huh. I guess we'll see what comes out of this. But their brain is a little sphere. And that was introduced in the series when they were trying to gather intelligence about what was going on in Westworld. Let's continue on. The next article is a buying guide. Six of the very best tourbillon watches of 2022. There's been no shortage of truly spectacular watches this year so far, and they doubt the author of this article. They doubt that they've seen the end of it for the remainder of the year. Companies spread out or released across the entire 12 months to who knows what splendor could be lurking on the horizon. So let's click the link. It'll take us over to monochrome-watches or just monochrome watches. The article is written by Robin Nooy, or Nooy, N-O-O-Y. I'm not quite sure how to pronounce it. But they talk about six of the very best tourbillon watches of 2022 so far. And I love these watches that show the internal machinery. The industrial design is always beautiful. Let's see. So Chopard LUC, I'm not sure if it's pronounced luck, if they pronounce it luck. Full strike tourbillon. It's a 42.5 by 12.58 millimeter watch, 18 karat ethical rose gold case and crown, integrated strike work pusher, sapphire crystal back, and a reasonable price of €377,000. Parmigiani Fleurier Tonda PF Flying Tourbillon. Let's see. This is really minimal, showing just a window of the internal works, the flywheel. And kind of a partially skeletonized back on the case. It's 42 millimeters by 8.6 millimeters, so very narrow. 950 platinum case, neural platinum bezel, so it's an entirely bezel, a platinum watch, apparently. It says 207 parts, 29 jewels, and let me see, so that at least maybe we can have some parity. One second. So, it's 140,000 Swiss francs, but that turns into 145,000, roughly 146,000 US dollars. Euro is off by maybe 25%, I think. Let me see what it really is. One second. Pardon me while I do all this work on the back end here. Yeah, so the euro, is, if it's a $377,000 euro watch, then it's 404,000 US dollars. Just over 404,000 US dollars. So 10% off or so. At any rate, the next one is the Audemars Piguet Royal Oak Self-Winding Flying Tourbillon 26730. That has like more industrial, more brutalistic kind of styling on the front of the case, but the watch face is bold, has a window for the inner workings, and a somewhat skeletonized back. So you can actually see through glass or crystal. And look at some of the components, and it's 192,000 euro, so just over 220 thousand US dollars. Roughly, there's a steel version, titanium version, gold version. The gold is obviously the most expensive one, at least for now. Vecheron, Constantine, Overseas, Tourbillon, Skeleton, 6000V. That one's skeletonized all over. I mean, you can almost see through it. It looks like you can see through it entirely. So that's really neat. I love being able to see the watchworks itself. The flywheel and the train of gears and everything. I mean, it's just amazing engineering. They all have, you know, near the same parts, right? But their design is so fundamentally different that I find it really interesting. That one's 150,000 euro, roughly, in pink gold, or 126,000 in titanium. And that comes around to about 140,000, 160,000 US dollars. Then there's the Grand Seiko Kodo Constant Forest Tourbillon SLG T003. And that one has just a beautiful face on it that you can see all of the gears. It has a lot of dimensionality to it. It's really nice. I love it. But all of these are so outside my ballpoint. My ballpark in terms of watches, and I wouldn't buy these. I think that they're too much for me. I don't change up my style enough to warrant something like this. So kudos to those who do find all of this, really interesting to, or that they desire for this. But the way that the crystal that covers the face of this watch gives it even greater dimensionality. It looks like it's bending light so that you can see deep into it. It's like a pool of water. You can just see deeper and deeper into it. It's really beautiful. But it's 370,000 euros. So add another 10% onto that for US dollars. So you're looking at just over 400 and I'd say maybe 10,000. But it's a 43.8 millimeter by 12.9 millimeter platinum 950 in brilliant hard titanium case. Open back, see-through case back. It's just really amazing, and it's water resistant. And then there's the Vincent Dupre Tourbillon Classic Subscription Edition. And this is really interesting design. I've never seen a watch with that kind of aesthetic. It kind of gives it a rustic feel to it. It's like everything else other than certain key elements like the flywheel and the face of the watch are sunken. Pardon me. And so there's like a floor underneath the works of the watch, and it has a lot of open space, some white space, so to speak, you know. It's really interesting. You can see the mechanism for the crown. You can see on the case back, it's open, it's clear. So there's a pane of glass there that you can actually see the train of gears. It's really neat. That's really neat. Anyway, it's 39 millimeters by 11.3 millimeters. So a lot of that dimensionality is just open space. So it doesn't need to be 11.3 millimeters other than for the aesthetic. And it comes in at only 89,500. Let me see. 89,000, huh? Where is it? Pardon me, I'm actually trying to do the numbers on the fly here. So it comes to 92,540 roughly US dollars, as opposed to 89,500 Swiss francs. That's really neat. Anyway, if you want to read more about it and see the actual pictures, then go over to monochrome-watches.com and do a search or follow the link in the show notes. If you go over to monochrome-watches.com, then you'll want to look for six of the very best Herbion watches of 2022 so far. The next article is in the Daily News show. That's this show. And it's Apple sees virtual reality headset as its next big thing. I don't think that there is anything that has made that claim, really. But they are apparently rumors out there that they're spending some money. And it says here, the company enlisted Hollywood directors like Jon Favreau to help its effort to create products that blend the physical and virtual worlds. So that, I don't think this is really virtual reality as so much as augmented reality. I really hope that these are augmented reality glasses or mixed reality. So let's click this link and takes us over to New York Times. The article is by Trip Mickle and Brian X. Chen. Nearly 15 years after the iPhone sparked the smartphone revolution, Apple is assembling the pieces for what it hopes to become its next business-altering device, a headset that blends the digital world with the real one. The company's enlisted Hollywood directors such as Jon Favreau to develop content. Executive producer of Prehistoric Planet on Apple TV Plus is working to bring the show's dinosaurs to life in the headset, which would look like a pair of ski goggles. I hope not. I hope that they have two, one that is ski goggles and one that is just normal glasses, because I think augmented reality is really where it's at. I've said this multiple times now, and I don't know, maybe like Mean Girls and Fetch, I'm going to make it happen. Hopefully it does happen, but I'd rather have two different devices that are uniquely positioned to capture both markets. Augmented reality, where you are not pulled out of the real world, and virtual reality, where you are entirely pulled into a virtual world. But we will see. We will see. Coming tomorrow, as a matter of fact. But there's a lot of rumors floating around. So last year, Meta's chief executive, Mark Zuckerberg, dropped Facebook as his company's name and committed to building the concept known as the Metaverse, where the online, virtual, and real worlds coalesce into a new universe. That's not... Okay, well, I guess as long as Metaverse includes augmented reality, but they don't talk about that. Everything that is related to Zuckerberg's version of Metaverse seems to be in the virtual reality space, and Metaverse should be more expansive, including the augmented reality side of things. Says he and others believe it could become the next wave of computing, succeeding the smartphone age dominated by Apple iOS and Google's Android software, much as those platforms followed the decades of Windows and Macintosh. Except the reason why the phone is so prolific is that it is multifunctional, whereas VR pulls you out of one world into a virtual world. Augmented reality does not do that. But isn't as capable as virtual reality in dragging you into a virtual space. Augmented reality has its own social implications, its own social problems. VR, you can be sitting in your office or your bedroom or wherever in a virtual world and you're not impacting anybody. Although there are now people that are arguing over sexual harassment in virtual space. That is a discussion that is for another time. But I certainly have opinions on it. So we'll see tomorrow what comes out of WWDC's keynote. The next article is over in the Hatch Ideas channel. Mercedes-Benz issues global recall of 1 million older cars. They've announced it is immediately recalling more than 1 million older vehicles worldwide due to problems with the braking system. The German Federal Transport Authority, KBA, said that the recall affected cars built between 2004 and 2015 of the SUV series ML and GL and the R-Class luxury minivan. So let's click the link. It'll take us over to The Guardian. And it says Agency France Presse is the author of this. And that's pretty much the nuts and bolts of this. 993,407 vehicles were being recalled worldwide, including 70,000 in Germany. This article is basically from Germany. It's not known how many vehicles in the UK are affected. It doesn't say anything about the US. Corrosion on the brake booster can, in the worst case, lead to the connection between the brake pedal and braking system being interrupted. So as a consequence, the service brake can stop functioning, which is bad. In such a very rare case, it would not be possible to decelerate the vehicle via the service brake. Thus, the risk of a crash or injury would be increased. So, and I believe the service brake is the emergency brake here in the States. So let's continue on. If you've got a Mercedes, you're going to want to at least get your car checked if there's a recall or not. And then finally, in the last article for today in the Hatch Ideas channel, aggregated from The Guardian, is "We're Still Struggling," a statement that's made by somebody in this article. Low unemployment can't hide impact of low wages and rising inflation. And low wages, it continues to be a problem in that inflation has increased. The cost of living was increasing, and cost of living wasn't being offset by wages increasing. So while the cost of living increased at 3%, people were getting 1.5 or no raises. And so, but the executive suite and administrators were still getting it. Okay. If you look around, that's just how it was working out. Because it's seen as them saving money by basically turning the underlings into cattle, where you could just replace them when they get bent out of shape, that they're not making enough money, even though everybody else that remains was getting raises. You know, the regular Joes weren't getting raises. Then inflation comes and the cost of living skyrockets, CPI skyrockets. Basically, everybody is doubly screwed, and you end up with people doing the great resignation. Ultimately, they'll have to get a job, though, because it's hard to eat air. And a lot of people are, a lot of leadership is sociopathic enough that they just say, well, you'll just take what I give you, which is, you know, I do fault a person for making that statement. Sometimes you can't pay more, but when there is income disparity between, well, salary disparity between a CEO making $20 million a year plus the additional compensation package simply because they've survived long enough, and the regular Joe 9-to-5 workers barely getting by, I think that there's a real sociopathic problem here. Workers in Las Vegas are still feeling the effects of employers' pandemic cuts, all made worse by rising inflation and low wages. It's an article by Dominic Rush. In the rotating restaurant at the top of the Strat Hotel and Casino, guests can once again enjoy $20 cocktails or a $90 shellfish display. Might as well call it shellfish display for two, while taking in an expansive view of downtown Las Vegas from its landmark tower. After the COVID shutdown, Vegas is back in business, but not everyone seems happy or sure how long it'll last. On a recent afternoon, just out of view of the hotel's 1,000 feet plus spike, a couple of hundred hospitality service workers were gathered in a nearby car park in baking 90-degree weather. Speakers told the workers that they must fight to get improved contracts and controls for soaring rents. Yeah, that's what unions are all about. But companies deploy union busters to break it up or prevent it, because it isn't lucrative to have happy, well-compensated employees if it's going to impact your bottom line. And that said, if you can't afford the required workers at the cost that it truly costs without abusing them, then you aren't a viable enterprise. If you are abusing your employees, then I think you should be shut down. So start your unions, folks. If you don't have bargaining power and your employer isn't listening to you, start your union. And don't let anybody stand in your way. Nobody's going to give you a pay raise out of the kindness of their heart unless they are a kind and compassionate employer. And you don't become a billionaire by being kind and compassionate, sympathetic to the employee plight. If you have the means, you typically, if you have the means to start up a business and employ a bunch of people, for some strange reason, there just seems to be this parity with trying to screw everybody over to protect yourself, which is fine, but if you're making millions of dollars and you have employees that are struggling because your salary doesn't pay for $10 gas in California, I think we've got a bigger problem here with society. So with that is the end of my articles that have been aggregated into Ometown. I add a little bit of context and perspective to the news. I hope that you enjoy the show. I always bring us back to the very front page where I refresh it so that it repopulates, and I let you know that the news is always being injected into Ometown. Then I grab a bunch of headlines and I talk about it for about an hour. Today, about 55 minutes. At any rate, I want to thank you for coming. Again, I'm Mayor Watt. That's Ometown, ometown.com. Go over there, sign up, become a citizen of Ometown. And I hope you enjoyed today's show. I'll see you tomorrow at 11 o'clock. Thank you very much. Bye bye.